Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson. And together we are
a Jew
and a Gentile
walk into a bar mitzvah.
Wishing I could change the things that I screwed up. What am I supposed to do? I can't give up. You know I can't give up.
And with that, so welcome into episode 86 to our podcast where you've come to find the theology, the cigars, the whiskey, and of course the F-bombs.
Was that my space to say fuck?
That's your cue.
Yes, that's your cue.
Fuck.
So we're here. The usual three suspects are here. We've got the Jew, the Gentile, and the Reverend Ampersand of Reason.
Mm-hmm.
Our podcast is now available on Stitcher, as well as Theology Corner at theologycorner.net, or wherever you find the podcasts that you enjoy.
Right, or ours.
Either one. Yes. Because most people play this to punish their children.
Right. Blessed are those that listen to our podcast because they're going to fill in the blank.
Yeah. Eat your vegetables. There are people listening to the Jew and the Gentile podcast in India. But that's my mother used to say that all the time to me. She'd make me listen to my own podcast if I didn't eat my vegetables. So now there's nowhere to go from there.
That got weird.
For acknowledging our sponsors as we do at the top of our
podcast. They may not want you to now. I mean,
Of course they would. Pastor Gnar, Men of the Beard Oil.
Yep. Still got some.
I'm still using mine. Virgil Cain Whiskey, the official rye whiskey of our podcast.
We got into some of that last Sunday or Super Bowl Sunday. Some of y'all did. I enjoyed the Doc Porter's bourbon that we had.
Some of us were drinking the Virgil Cain as well. You had to have something to get through that game.
Right. It's a Super Bowl sponsored by Ennui.
Oh, gosh.
Now for most football fans, we're going to have to define what Ennui is. But anyway.
Yeah, because obviously they're not from Duke because it was football.
No, but if you're listening to our podcast, you are well acquainted with Ennui. I mean, it really.
And just entre nous, if you're listening to our podcast.
What were we talking about? Oh, yeah. Sponsors.
Sponsors. Pipe and
Virgil Cain. That's good stuff.
Virgil Cain. Good stuff. Pipe and Pint.
The one on Spring Garden.
In Greensboro. That's right.
And we still no word on the one in Winston, but we did learn that our good friend Larry will be sort of captaining that.
Yeah. So that's good for you guys up that way. I still have to see Pete then when I go in there. Oh, well.
Well, only if you look at, if you keep looking straight ahead.
Straight ahead, then I can miss him. Yeah.
Right.
He doesn't usually get, just like most jokes, I go over his head.
Right.
Are there sponsors?
Hey, it's not my dog being a psycho that I have to edit out this week.
Well, you have to give him some Four Saints beer from Four Saints Brewing Company.
Get the dog drunk?
Yeah, exactly. So. That's what we do to our audience at Wild Goose. That's why it's always our best audience.
We had better booze than the other
always do.
Show up with booze. I mean,
yeah, we always do. Because we bring Four Saints and Virgil Cain.
Yeah, it's really sad. I've gotten a dog drunk once in my life. But it wasn't on.
Not Virgil a pretty picture.
Four Saints. It was on the Gentleman Jack single barrel that I thought was just regular old Jack Daniels. My friend that was hosting me that weekend was rather pissed when he got off night shift to discover that his really super expensive bottle of whiskey
had been drunk by his dog.
Dog and me as a guest. Yeah. The hell did you and Scooby? The dog's name is actually Scooby. I'm not making that up. So Scooby and I got hammered. We sat on the couch and watched movies and got yelled at when my buddy came in and found the bottle sitting near the dog's bowl, and both of us passed out on the couch.
Excellent. Four Saints would do that. Yeah, not me.
I'm just playing with the thing. Sorry. I didn't realize it'd be that loud. I'm fidgeting. Sorry.
Fidgeting. Like, don't fidget over our sponsors.
Sorry.
You can fidget over either one of us talking, but
Not over sponsors.
Did we mention Top Leaf?
I was about to get to Top Leaf.
You should do that.
Yeah, Top Leaf, the premier cigar lounge in the Triad.
They've been doing some really neat package deals, four or five of a certain brand, and they've really knocked out of the park. The Viaje Party, I saw a few days ago three My Fathers, including the La Opulenza, which got great reviews this year in Cigar Aficionado. Mm-hmm. I seem to remember they had another one a few days ago.
I saw something pop up.
They had a black label one for the Super Bowl.
That was it. That was it.
And that was excellent. I picked that up. Very good. Had a Killer Bee, Last Rites, Benediction, Papa Joe. That was very good. So, speaking of cigars, what are we smoking tonight?
You're the only one smoking, jackass.
Well, see, I keep telling you, Chris, no one can see us, so...
They know.
They know because you keep telling them.
They know now.
Well, Helena's not smoking either.
They know Says that who? Now. How do you, yeah. Prove it. Let's see pictures. For all anybody knows, she could be smoking a really good cigar right now.
Mm-hmm.
There are more than one way to smoke. It can be an adjective as well as a verb. There.
It's still pretty shaky.
Somebody do a cigar review quickly, please.
Okay, the last one I smoked, because I'm not smoking right now, is Chris called
See,
out.
See, she gave the, it away.
Well, after you gave it away, fucker. Jesus. So, the Chillin' Moose.
Oh, that's a good...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Really, really, really well-priced, first of all. Like, $5 for a stick, and it was really a decent little cigar. It's Connecticut binder... No, Connecticut wrapper, Nicaraguan filler, Mexican filler, Corona. That was the one that tasted like raisins, dude. It was crazy. The cold draw tasted like raisins. The smoke was kind of medium bodied, a little bit creamy, a little bit of cocoa, a little bit of spice. It was a good cigar for, especially, like I said, for the price point. It's one of the Foundry cigars. So that's my review.
It was good. That's another one at Top Leaf we picked up.
It was good, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like I said, especially considering it was a $5 stick, I was a little bit suspicious, but it was a good smoke.
I had one a few weeks ago. The draw started off a little bit too drinking straw for me, but it cleared up pretty quickly and just really came together. And you're kind of, you're left wondering. It's a very large cigar for the most part for a $5 price point. I mean, so you see that one out there, give it a go. You'll be pleasantly surprised. I agree.
Yeah, I was. So what are you not smoking, Chris?
Oh, what am I not smoking? So I'm going to review the one I had during Super Bowl, one of the two. I had a Boondock Saints, but this one was a gift from Cigar Mom, which I'm assuming now. What now?
I know which one you're doing.
Right. So it's the one you weren't smoking as I was enjoying it. Yeah. But I'm assuming this is now evidence that I'm no longer being blamed for the Steelers not making the Super Bowl, because Cigar Mom did feed me, allow me in her house to drink her alcohol. I got a flask for Christmas from her finally. I didn't know I had a gift there. That was nice. And then the cigar I'm going to review, the Ramonayones, not by AJ Fernandez, but the Cuban Puro, 5x50 Robusto. Now, the thing that I didn't realize, and I went back several times to check, is that the one that they had and they gave us, Charles, was the number two cigar for 2015. Ramonayones has got some great pedigree, because it's not one that you think up there like with the Cohibas and the Bahiquis. It's kind of a rustic looking cigar. It's not a pretty looking cigar.
Yeah.
But it and makes
it's
up
one of the,
for it.
It's one of the oldest labels in Cuba, is Ramonayones.
So this thing, the cold draw and the foot, and it really kind of lasted throughout. I couldn't really describe it. I'm going to try. But it almost reminded me of incense. It just had a lot of things going on in it, that you had the sweet, and you had floral, and you had, so I'll just read. I detected earth, cedar, floral notes, red pepper, dark chocolate, caramel, cream, leather, molasses, nuts, and then citrusy and vanilla. I mean, it's like going to a candy store in like one cigar.
I was going to say, that's a lot going on in one cigar.
It is, but it comes off as balanced. You get all of it at once, kind of like, I guess the thing that I thought of first of all, it's kind of like an ice cream sundae. It's got so much different flavors going on, but together it works.
Hmm.
So it's not a one note wonder by any stretch of the imagination. And it throughout the whole thing, it was just delightful. Good construction, good draw. The Cigar Mom and Trucker Jeff knocked it out of the park buying that box. All right, Charles, which cigar are you going to review now?
I'm going to review the Diesel 10th Anniversary. Diesel is one of the lines we've been enjoying. It's a AJ Fernandez without his name on it. It's one of the many cigars out there that if you know it's an AJ Fernandez, you know to pick it up. It's like Ave Maria, The Man of War. This is the Diesel line. Everyone we've had has been very good. All the tobacco is obviously coming from AJ's farm, well constructed. And this is the cigar to celebrate the 10th anniversary of him launching that line. And this is a cigar that is as good as any cigar that has his name on it.
Right.
Put this up there with the New World, the Enclave. It's just excellent. So it's a Ecuador Habano Oscuro wrapper that is as dark as the label that is on it. Nicaraguan binder and filler. Well, the wrapper is almost black. It's such almost a heavy black. Is a heavy Oscuro.
I'm interrupting you.
I know you are.
But I mean, after I did the Ramon Ayones, you're kind of like whatever act followed.
Yeah,
in Monterey or Woodstock. I mean, it's just
that
guy. Oh yeah, by the way.
Yeah. I'm following, you know, Jimi Hendrix playing the Star Spangled Banner at sunrise here.
You were reviewing
not
quite
as not as complex, but earthy, dark chocolate, roast coffee, all those not quite sweet but not savory, luscious flavors, and just well balanced. A lot of smoke, and like I said, I'd put this up against just about anything else AJ's got his name on. Excellent smoke. Really enjoying it.
He's had a good run.
Yes, he has.
He's really, you know, for as many things that his name's on the label or he's a part of it, he's not become Walmart, you know, where he just does everything but does everything really shitty.
Right.
He's been consistent.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And now for something completely different.
So before we get into our main topic tonight, we're recording this the day after the State of the Union address was delivered.
I didn't watch it. I went Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't watch it either.
It was in NPR this morning.
Yeah. Exactly. You didn't miss much. There was, I would say that whoever wrote the last stanza of the speech should get a raise because rhetorically it was excellent. Whoever wrote the opening stanza of the speech should go back to kindergarten
because right.
It was atrocious. Doggerel is never a good idea, but when you write words to come out of the President of the United States standing in the well of the House of Representatives, an 8-part doggerel just with...
You realize that his supporters are now going to PetSmart to figure out what the fuck a doggerel is.
Well, you know that his supporters are not listening to us.
No.
So
that require power and, you know, electricity and, you know, and taking
ability,
a break
ability to think.
From your really attractive cousin.
Yeah. So that was just awful. It was interesting that he threatened Congress in the United States with war if they perform their constitutional duty of oversight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the other very interesting thing was that he spoke almost entirely to the left side of the room, which was where all the Republicans were sitting.
Oh, there's a change.
He hardly looked at the Democratic side.
I did like Nancy Pelosi's, I don't know, fuck you hand clap she gave him.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the meme that was circulating today with she's looking at some papers.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Mueller report, page 3, you know.
Although her daughter, though, had the best response. She tweeted out that she's seen that clap before. That's the sarcastic mom. Oh, I know what you did. And I know you know that I know what you did. Nice try.
so, she said that's a mom clap.
Yeah, that's a mom clap. And
I took a quote.
I've objected to everybody who's ever done those speeches who brings in their guests as political prop.
Was this the little kid that got?
But not just the little kid. He did every marginalized group that he has insulted. He had representatives of them there.
Did he bring token black guy back from the campaign?
No, he had two token blacks. To tout
like two Corinthians.
Right. To tout his great justice reform.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all, well, see, I can't be racist. I invited two black people to the State of the Union.
Would you let him live in one of your buildings?
No.
Right.
He had, you know, America's great today because he had these three men who stormed the beaches of Normandy on D-Day.
Was he the same people? No, that was World War I. He couldn't be bothered to get himself wet.
No, this was...
Okay, sorry, yeah. Sorry, wrong war. Yeah,
wrong war. But also he had a survivor from the Tree of Life shooting. He also had a Holocaust survivor. So, hey, I can't be anti-Semitic. I invited Jews to the State of the Union.
I just get this pill, whoever that was, Maury's like, holy fuck, where did I... I'm hoping he was senile enough that he didn't know where he was at.
Probably.
Or I guess it would be even more commentaries like...
Yeah, you guys think...
You thought D-Day was a pain in the ass. Shit, it was over quicker than this goddamn.
One of the worst parts was he took credit for all the new women in Congress.
Oh, yeah, that was hilarious.
Yeah, which in some ways is true because they got elected because they ran against him.
Uh-huh.
Well, right. And, you know, because he didn't have time to grab them in the vagina there.
Yeah. But I thought it was interesting that a lot of women, some that I know who are on social media, were commenting about the attire of the women representatives on the Democratic side in Congress.
I don't like that. People wearing white. He's fucking nuts about people wearing white. Usually it's longer robes and pointy hats, but... Well,
but see, that's the thing. Now, there's a reason they wore white.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Constitutional Amendment. Right. Giving, you know, enfranchising women in this country and giving them the vote. And so it's very interesting that a female acquaintance of mine didn't just say it was kind of like, but actually called them out as the only thing missing from their outfits was their hoods and that they were the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, they missed that whole.
Yeah.
The joke's there, but not the, but it's.
No, she wasn't joking. She was saying.
She thinks that, they're Klansmen?
Yeah, that they looked like the Klan and they acted like the Klan and the only thing missing were their hoods.
Huh.
Yeah.
That sounds like crazy aunt. I don't have to listen to you till Christmas, and I'm not going to talk to you on social media.
Yeah, this was, you know, and all her other female friends agreeing. Yeah, so it was terrible what they were wearing, and they looked like petulant.
Did their husbands know they were on the computer and watching TV when dishes were available to be done?
I know.
They took a break from being barefoot and pregnant?
Yeah, long enough to be outraged that women were celebrating the fact that they could vote.
I don't understand. Republican women that vote Republican make about as much sense as poor people voting Republican. It's like, do you just hate yourself? Do you just like, I like voting against my own interests?
Well, no, what they liked was when he slammed the state of New York for passing a law that allows doctors to
reform late-term abortions.
Well, not that. It's that
Mrs. Trump should have done that at some point.
Yeah. No, in the words of the president, it's that they can hack up and rip out of a womb a viable baby moments before it's born.
Yeah, a lot of people are confused about that.
Yeah, that's not what late-term abortion means. You know, the place went crazy over that, and they cheered and stood up and applauded. Of course, all the men did, and all the Republican women did.
Right, because otherwise they'd have a lot of child support to pay.
Yeah. So that was just
the nonsense with the governor in Virginia is that at least Democrats called out their own party and say you've got to step down rather than applauding them.
Yeah,
you know, and that's a whole other pot.
Yeah, because something's going on there. Somebody's doing something because now they've got an accuser coming forward with sexual abuse charges against the lieutenant governor.
I saw that tonight.
And then the third person in the line of succession, the attorney general had to apologize for appearing in blackface in his past.
The fuck is going on in Virginia? Damn.
Yeah. And you realize if all three of those step down, the governor of Virginia will be the Republican speaker of the legislature.
Which is really sad that he's the one moral person, or at least hadn't been accused of shit yet.
I was going to say so far.
Well, you've got to wonder how is this coincidence or orchestrated to get these three Democrats out of office and get a Republican into power in Virginia, which could be an important state in 2020.
Oh, political theater aside, what they did was wrong.
Oh, absolutely.
If they did what they did. Actually, the governor, it's like, okay, I've worn blackface when I was in med school. It's just not me in this picture. Byron had a great
take
on it.
Yeah.
I've done it, but not this time. So it's all cool. Yeah, Byron did a good, Byron Williams, good friend of the podcast, or at least smokes cigars with us and enlightens us with his wisdom. Had some good tweets on that.
Yeah. What'd he say?
What I just butchered it, that, you know, that you're not upset that he wore blackface at all, but just you're okay with him doing it, just not in that picture.
Right.
And we'll post it on there. Our site, so that Byron actually gets credit for sounding articulate as he always does versus me butchering. I do have a quote to share from our good friend at Liberty University, Jerry Falwell Jr.
Yeah.
Have you heard this one?
Yes.
Best State of the Union speech in my lifetime delivered by the best at POTUS since George Washington. and it's not even over yet. God bless at real Donald Trump. Lots of exclamation points. Now, my favorite rebuttal to this is, and we follow her on our Twitter feed, Miss Betty Bauer is America's best Christian. And it's a farce. I mean, she just does the character as a bit. Her quote was, "Christianity promotes the businessman, not because the businessman is a Christian, but because Christianity is a businessman. Hashtag tax the churches." And I amen the last bit. Hashtag, my wife's like, "Well, you're going to kill a lot of churches that are doing some good stuff." I was like, "Yeah, but you're going to take a shitload of rubbish out with them. You start taxing the churches, you'll lose." I mean, Joel Osteen and a whole bunch of people are going to be out of work. Mm-hmm. I mean, think of the trade-off.
They've done away with the purpose of making them tax exempt by loosening the restrictions on political speech from the pulpit, because that was the trade-off. Churches agreed not to be political if the government agreed, you know, say, "Hey, let's do this whole separation of church and state.
This would be
you
a
won't
great
tax
segue.
Us, and we won't say things from the, we won't endorse candidates, we won't make ministers won't make public political statements." Now that they've taken that restriction off, the excuse for not taxing them sort of gone.
Tax them.
Yeah.
And now for something completely different.
The Pipe and Pint is the Triad's oldest brick-and-mortar tobacconist and specialty store. It's located in the heart of beautiful Greensboro, North Carolina, at 3716 Spring Garden Street, boasting the Triad of the North Carolina's largest selection of new and estate pipes, rare tobaccos, premium cigars, a favorite of the Jew and a Gentile, and accessories, all while complemented by many of the world's most sought-after wines and over 400 craft beer selections. Again, that's the Pipe and Pint, Greensboro, North Carolina, 3716 Spring Garden Street.
So last episode, we took a look at the first 10 of the 613 commandments.
We got through two. We got through one.
Yeah.
Well, it's the first in our 613-part series.
Right.
I had named that episode the Decalogue and Beatitudes. And
our house indie band.
It's
Decalogue and the Beatitudes.
Yeah. So, great tour of the Middle East.
Yeah. They're huge.
Huge.
Sri Lanka. We're going to be big Sri Lanka and whatever other country we're now getting hits in.
Philippines. That's scary. Uh-huh. Yeah. But Rev Helena said, "Well, since you mentioned Beatitudes, we need to give equal time. And so we're going to tackle those."
Reverend Mother for this podcast?
Sure.
Okay.
Or just all the time is fine.
Or Sister Helena. That works on a Baptist and Catholic level.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's a whole other thing.
Of course, both of them are wondering why she's called Reverend. But anyway.
Yeah.
What the hell are you talking about?
So we're going to kick it over to you, Rev Helena Ampersand.
Well, like you said, Charles, I just thought that, like we mentioned in the last podcast, that the kind of complement to the Ten Commandments in the Christian New Testament is the Beatitudes. And it's interesting because they're not commandments, they're blessings, right? And I just, honestly, like being raised outside of the Christian tradition, I'm a little bit curious to hear from Chris about how this text is understood in kind of cultural context, but then also digging in a little bit to the content. I'm just mostly interested in the juxtaposition between the agreement made in the Ten Commandments in relationship, like as commandments from God to the people for how to treat one another, versus the Beatitudes as kind of a statement of the potential blessings that come upon people for their actions in the world. It's just a different angle that's taken. But I really just wanted to kind of hash through it a little bit with you guys and pick your brains and see what your thoughts were.
Right. I mean, growing up, and I don't know if it says more about the churches I grew up in, and I've always been Methodist, or just my own awareness, but I think I was a pretty clued in and paying attention, especially over the course of sermons, Sunday school, worship services, vacation Bible schools, collectively. But the first thought I had when you made that comment was, well, it's kind of like Hallmark cards. Like, this is stuff you'd find framed, you know, neatly in some old lady's bathroom.
Usually a needlepoint.
Well, but it is. And it's just sort of, you know, kind of nice sayings But when I got to Duke and got introduced to liberationists, African American church, and other worldviews and theologies other than, you know, mediocre middle of the road Methodism, these words took on a whole different power.
Oh yeah, they're very potent, I think.
And especially if you extend the Beatitudes as sort of an into the Sermon on the Plain, the Sermon on the Mount if you're in Matthew, and you take all of that teaching as one, and there's debate of the way you should do it that way, as one sort of manifesto, if you will, for Jesus.
Right. I mean, because obviously, right, I've been doing exegesis on the Sermon on the Plains, and the Sermon on the Plains comes right after his kind of contention with the rabbis over the Sabbath and around healing. So in some ways, it's almost a response to that conversation. And then obviously, the blessing on the plain doesn't end with the blessing and woes, but extends.
Oh, no, it's got woes. It's got woes.
It's got woes, yeah. It extends into, you know, a conversation about love and about forgiveness and about judgment.
And about faith and action.
Faith and action, right? So it's really
also, let's put in here for those of you who are playing along at home that we're looking at Luke 6:17 through 46.
Yes. One of the things that also, like, when I hear the word blessing, I tend to hear it from still kind of with Jewish ears, right? Like that it's blessing is something that comes from God, right? That like there's, yeah, that you, God is blessed, and therefore things like goodness comes from that. But this text very distinctly like is blessing the people, and the word for blessing is different. Like it actually means like happiness or righteousness. It doesn't mean blessing in the same way that I'm used to thinking about blessing. So I've been trying to wrap my head around that a little bit too.
And the fact that you went with the Gentile over the Matthean, more Hebrew Jewish sort of, well, if we believe Luke to be written toward a more Gentile audience.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Or is it, well, do I get those backwards? I may have got those backwards. If I did, then
no, you didn't.
All I just said
you didn't.
Well, the point
you have, you've got it straight.
The note that I have in my version has blessed meaning happy or favored by God.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the same word that's used for Mary when during the Annunciation in Luke, the favored one. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I've really been appreciating is this juxtaposition of blessing and woe, right? Like that, because it comes right after a healing. So in some ways, like if you've been healed, you're now in a position of potential for woe to occur, but Jesus did the healing, right? So there's this kind of like a dichotomy that I think is easy to, would be kind of the tension between like being blessed and being in a state of woe. It's easy to like turn it into a black and white state of being, but in reality, we're all in a constant state of flux between these two things. And in some ways, I think for me, the only way to reconcile that is an incarnational theology, right? That like we inhabit the state of blessing and the state of woe at all times. And if you're in a state of blessedness, it's because you have people who are in this potential woe state, people who have more resources than you can provide blessing, right? And by giving up of yourself, you can then receive as well. So there's this kind of, indwelling that occurs between the two that I really have been geeking out about a little bit. So yeah, I have the whole like needlepoint on the bathroom of your grandma's wall thing is like, that's pretty potent stuff to have needle pointed on your bathroom wall.
Well,
they do the first, they do the blessed ours and not the woe twos.
Right.
Needle point.
Yeah. They never get to the verse 46 in chapter 6.
Right.
Why do you call me Lord, Lord, yet don't do what I say? Don't do what I command.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, that in and of itself, the 46 is interesting because that to me sort of solves the whole deed versus creed debate that's been going on for centuries in Christianity.
Mm.
You know, I've just finished reading history of the First Great Awakening, and part of that was when the Church of England started to divide, and it was dividing particularly around church governance in a very practical sense, but also the theological divide was what was more important, belief or good deeds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, that's kind of seems settled in that verse 46 or 48, that one is like a man that talking about coming to hear, but not, you know, you hear my words, but don't act on them. The one is like a man building a house who dug deeply and laid the foundation on rock. When a flood arose, a river burst against the house, but could not shake it because it had been built well. But the one who hears and does not act is like a man who built a house on the ground without a foundation. It's not enough just to come and hear my words and believe in me. You have to then act on these words and on that belief.
I remember ethics class. It was, I think it was actually precept, but it was quoting the great Stanley Hiawatha at some level, that the preceptor, remember, for our ethics course, said he read like the Beatitudes. And then he looked at what was largely a white male audience and says, if this didn't make you uncomfortable, you're not fucking paying attention. Which at that point, I was wrapped. I was like, all right.
Well, yeah. You know what is interesting is I'm just thinking about this whole like faith versus the creed versus deed or the faith versus action. And in some ways, just that verses 20 through 26 could be read through that lens, right? That they're not, it juxtaposes the two, right? Those that are blessed are those who have to have faith that they'll be provided for or not, right? Those that have woes are those that have an opportunity for action.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the two don't work separately.
Right.
You can't really, from my perspective, you can't really privilege one over the other, although it's tempting to.
And that's a whole Western tendency to want to privilege. But also, you can find the equivalent in verse 27 to the going back to the Ten Commandments to Sinai.
Say, love your enemy, yeah.
And the revelation, no, in the sense that what God commanded before presenting the commandments was that the people listen and heard. And in the Hebrew, it's an active verb. My wife, and that's Dr. Mrs. Judy U, Chris, in her dissertation.
The better part of you.
Much better part. Did a whole thing on how the importance of hearing and listening as active and the precursor to action. And that's very much paralleled in verse 27. But I say to you that listen, and then what are we listening to? It's commands to do things.
Yeah. Right? Love your enemies, do good to those who.
Right. But first you have to listen. You have to hear this. And then Now that I have your attention and you're listening, go do these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, there's a tendency, if we're going back to how my own personal narrative is. Yeah.
I just wanted to finish that it's not just listening, but what her point was and what most of the rabbis will say is that by listening, we mean understanding.
Understand, right.
Right. One of these acts happen
through understanding.
One of the big shifts that for me, when I, as a divinity student, sort of revisited my faith, which is really, that's a story unto itself, but is that what happens with what ends up on your grandma's wall cross-stitched is even with those sort of very prophetic words, what we do and what happens in many churches, and I certainly grew up with it. I can name one pastor that had actually ended up having the most impact on me, but made me feel very uncomfortable as a middle schooler. Because his message really challenged. You aren't comfortable. He was the first person that said, I'm here to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. But he didn't over-spiritualize the Beatitudes. And that seems to be we're going to weaken it. It's, you know, it's all the rich, you know, poor, versus them being economic categories or, you know, and it just waters it down.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I wasn't really ever fucking pissed when I listen to this. If it doesn't upset you, you're not paying attention.
Well, it is uncomfortable, right? Like, I'm not in a position of poverty and I'm not hungry and I'm not mourning right now. But I also was considering that most people at some point in their life will fit into one of those categories.
Right. Mm-hmm. Either right? side of it.
On both sides. Like, there's no way to live a full life without having some experience of poverty, hunger, or mourning, or the opposite, right? Joy and fullness and something else, and richness of some sort, right? That we all in some capacity experience all of those categories to varying degrees, right?
Right. Right. That is life.
Right.
Life isn't just all pleasure, but it's not all suffering either.
Right.
That all these things occur.
Right. So I think that goes really well, syncs well with your point about listening, to being attentive, right? That to pay attention to those points in your life that you're at and recognize, am I in a position, if I'm in a position of, for this text, of woe, right? If I have the earthly things that I need, and if I'm in a position to help others, I need to listen and use that power for the benefit of others. If I'm not, if I'm on the other side, if I'm in the blessing category, I need to allow myself to be blessed by others, because I think that pride gets in the way a lot. People won't allow themselves to be comforted, won't allow themselves to be provided for, at least in our culture. Some people just aren't offered it, and that's a different scenario. But I'm thinking particularly with mourning in our culture, how little people will allow themselves to be fully comforted, right? They feel the need to mourn privately and to experience that sense of loss. It gets isolated, and that people don't allow themselves the vulnerability that's required to be comforted.
Which is an interesting, and keeping our interfaith theme here, that mourning in Judaism is public.
Is very public. Yeah. Mourning in Christianity tends to be very private. At least as I've experienced
culturally, that can be, the inner chaplain is going, oh, that's less Christianity and more culture, or so Charles, I got the million dollar question.
Okay.
So I know that I'm not going to get, and I don't expect much conversation on, is Jesus the fulfillment of the law, the telos. I get that.
Well, you are, because I have questions about that.
Right. So here's my thing, the claim that Jesus makes, that I'm not here to replace even a letter of the law. Does he or doesn't he?
Well, the way I look at that, because to me, most of the arguments I hear on that are sort of problematic, because a lot of times they're used as excuse for forcing conversion on Jews.
Right. Well,
but I would put it this way, and I was trying to formulate this maybe for another podcast, but I was like, I'll put this out there because I think this is something we can come back to, because that is a huge.
I know.
I texted it
to you 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was thinking about this, and this is a very, very important difference between Christianity and Judaism that can be exploited, like I said, by a lot of people to try to either denunciate or minimize Judaism. Or delegitimize it, or insist on conversion. And the way I was thinking about it is, it's, and this is going to sound really, really dark and strange. So you've got to remember.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, I know. Coming
surprise.
From me.
Surprise.
All right. So not at the time of Jesus's life, but at the time that the Gospels were written, is post-destruction of the temple.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, a huge chunk of mitzvot could not be performed because they were specifically about temple sacrifice. So they could not be done. And if you look at the Beatitudes and the other teachings of Jesus, they tend to be about all of the other relational mitzvot, about how to treat other people.
Mm.
So is there a sense in which the sacrifice of Christ does fulfill and replace the sacrifice that was done in the temple?
Oh, that's actually a pretty common.
Right? So it's just that part. So that I'm not replacing all of Judaism, but I've replaced the sacrificial cult. Right. But now what complicates that for me is the reversal of who is making the sacrifice for whom, because in the temple sacrifice, it's humans making a sacrifice in praise of God. Whereas if I understand correctly, God is sacrificing his son for the benefit of human.
That's, yeah, I bet that would be fairly creedal.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean,
do you find, maybe to simplify the question, because that it is a huge question. I knew I was going to slap you with it, but
and
you
no, that's why I've been thinking about it. And it's,
but
it does.
Is it a total? It does,
but it sets up a whole other set of problems. It doesn't solve anything for me as a Jew to then just say, "Oh, I'll just replace Christ for
ram
in the temple."
That's not where I was going with it. I think I could have maybe simplified the question a bit. Is it a real departure from what we see in the law? Like, is this like, okay, we're in
absolutely.
Okay, see, I wouldn't.
That's why I'm saying that if we understand it as Jesus saying that at the time in which the temple was still standing and sacrifice was still being done, then it's a huge, huge, huge departure. Nowhere in Torah, not even a prophet, says, "I am, you know, here my words are just as good as God's."
Oh, yeah, well, he pisses them off for reading the scroll in Nazareth and like, well, now in the hearing of this today.
So nowhere in Judaism do you have anybody claiming any kind of holiness or godliness. But if you do take it in the context of who was writing the Gospels, when and for what kind of audience, especially the more Hebraic Gospels that are like with Mark, whose ecclesia is only like one generation after the destruction, who are trying to figure out, oh, you know, now what are we supposed to do?
I don't even think Mark was trying to answer that question. Just
no, but that's you know, if you're a group of Jews and the main way you had of worshiping had been destroyed, that's an existential question asked. So what do we do now?
And wait, hold on, go back, Chris. Yeah. Did you just say that you don't think Mark was addressing that question?
No,
really.
Mark was the first gospel. I think that he's just trying to get the story down as a biographer as quick as possible. He sort of has
definitely going to have to talk about that more.
We have to talk about that, yeah.
He has sort of this expectation that Perusia is going to come immediately.
Because I definitely read that gospel as a really visceral response to the destruction of the temple.
Yeah, and it's from what I've understood and studied and have been taught is that that has a lot to do with his beef with the Pharisees, because they were both trying to do the same thing in different ways. Of what do we do now? What is being an Israelite, a Hebrew, or Jew mean if there's no sacrifice in the temple?
Yeah.
And our temple is destroyed. So that was an issue for Mark's generation. So it may not, he may not be trying to answer it directly, but that's part of the context in which he was writing. And that's what I'm saying, to offer this idea that, well, we can replace our temporal sacrifice with our faith and believe in a Christ, then that's gives a different context to the I haven't come to replace the law but to fulfill it.
Right, Matt, but Mark never has any of the passages that we're reading in Matthew and Luke. This is unique.
But I'm saying if we, you know, they're yes, more generations removed, but it's still post destruction and you're also then historically also, even though it's post destruction and it's several generations later, it's still very early on in the diaspora and a displacement of people by the Romans. And I think all these things complicate how we have to, or at least how Christians have to interpret that passage and specifically what laws are being fulfilled and replaced.
What was that like? I read this cursory that love your enemies, treat others the way you want to be treated. That sounds pretty Jewish.
Well, it is. That's what I'm saying. That because the laws that Jesus espouses are the rest of the mitzvot if you take out the ones relating to temple sacrifice.
Okay, that for some reason when you said at that time, like, well, that made a lot more sense. I don't know. You got that one down to a sentence for my less educated ears.
Right. So, you know, if we understand the time that was written, you know, it was impossible to perform those laws.
So it's what goes unmentioned in
Matthew. Exactly. Right.
Whether it was omitted or not is that's a whole nother argument, but
right.
Yeah, well, I think I think from my perspective, it was just understood by the original audience that was
very good point.
Right. That's concern. Right. And that's what I'm saying. And that if you look at this, Jesus is commanding that you do all of these things. So these laws apparently are still to be performed, like the command to love your neighbor, to give to the poor, to protect the widow and the orphan, to protect and have equal laws for the stranger. So,
and that's that impossible question of the historical Jesus, just how Jewish was he? And it's an impossible question to answer.
Right. But if you just look at which of the commandments he's espousing, those are the ones, and the ones that are not mentioned here are the only ones that could possibly be claimed that he's fulfilling, and those are the ones of sacrifice. And then that's when I get to then, now the whole sacrificial part becomes problematic. Because
I wonder if there's a link we could put where just visually it kind of sets that out. Because I think if I Googled that, I'm going to get a lot of the, we're just trying to convert Jews by saying, look, just come over to our side. It's basically the same, except
a visual of what?
Well, what the Sermon on the Plains, we were talking about Luke, or the Sermon on the Mount, looks like, where does it have parallels in the law? And then where is the departure? Where are the differences?
That would be really cool.
Yeah. But I'm also realizing I feel like if I Googled that right now, it would be heavily oriented towards evangelism and less just sort of textual criticism and, you know, historicity and all that.
Well, that might be a fun thing for us to do if we want to geek out.
Yeah.
If only we had somebody prone to rabbit holing when somebody comes up with an idea.
If only.
If only.
Such a person existed.
Yeah. We would definitely have her as part of our podcast.
What's really funny is
on a regular basis. That.
What?
I mean, either one of you could be the rabbit holer. I mean, because I've seen Charles go after stuff, which I conveniently leave myself out
like
of that.
Like a rabbit?
Yeah, really. You want to check that log? Sticking out of your
That's
eye.
That's in there.
I know. Well, gee, do you think I would have made an inappropriate allusion?
Never.
Inappropriate in what sense?
Not related to what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah. It's connected.
Exactly. It's contextually appropriate.
It's always these podcasts where I think like it's going to be, this is going to be drier than hell as far as, and then it just, anyway.
Dude, there's nothing dry about textual criticism. This stuff is so much fun.
I had a student yesterday. This is great, right? It's a college freshman. After classes, I got to ask you this question, and it's going to sound weird, but I promise you it's grammatical. So he was saying that at his church, and he's Southern Baptist, so it was the King James Version, and he's reading this passage that the minister used as the basis for their sermon. And he's like, now I'm reading this, and where this comma is, if we take this adjectival phrase, it could be modifying either this or this, which totally changes this. And I looked at all the different translations, and I looked at, you know, and he was just going on and on about how, wow, you know.
Did the comma even exist in the original or the earlier?
Well, that's what he went. He said, I don't know the Greek enough to go look at it, but he looked and the comma was there in all the different translations. And this is a college freshman, and he was just so excited about applying that depth of analysis.
But see, this isn't taught in churches. I'm example.
Yeah, that's what was bugging him was that, you know, he was reading along with his minister's sermon, and he's like looking at it, going, "Well, man, if I move that last clause, wow, that just totally changed that whole verse."
Well, and there's not a tradition. I'll leave it in there. I don't have a better word. Yeah. But that sort of like, if you're a really good exegete, you probably shouldn't go work in a local church. Mm-hmm. You need to be in academia. And I've had a number of really good friends who also are brilliant preachers that those men and women have inverted that, going, no, I am a good exegete, a great exegete. I need to be in the local church.
Yeah.
You don't, you know, I guess it's kind of like you don't have chefs working at McDonald's.
Right.
But churches are kind of oftentimes just wanting the, you know, the $5 fill up sort of sermon versus somebody that really knows how to type
the text. Meal.
Right.
Yeah. So, but my point is that it's not just Helena and I, but there are other people out there in the world who can rabbit hole. Because, you know, he said that he spent, when he got home, he went online and he found every different translation he could find, and, you know,
looking for that comma.
Looking for
wait that, till you get a letter from his parents.
Yeah,
my son is thinking. We didn't tell him to do that growing up.
Yeah, especially because he said
something anti-Semitic in Christ, anyway, and whatever the kid's parents. Which think.
And also. Somewhat related. There's a great, have you seen the meme going around?
Which one?
One that I can accomplish anything by taking any verse out of context.
Yes, I have seen that. I have seen that.
I remember, I can't remember what, it's in Matthew. It's basically where Satan says, worship me. Mm-hmm. When Jesus is in the desert being tried for 40 days. And I actually signed one of the chaplain interns. I think it was a Bible. He was like, I want everybody's autograph. And I wrote that down as a scripture verse. and then signed my name. And it was like a couple weeks before he
finally said, "Oh, that was John Monroe, dude."
Yeah. His name's John. But, and he's just like, "What the hell did you see? I told you. I had the scripture verse. Context is everything. Love, Chris." Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, he's like, "Okay."
Everything is just commentary. Go and study.
Well,
see, got to bring in Hillel.
Yep.
Wasn't Rambam or Heschel, but I got a Rashi or Hillel comment in there.
Nice. Hillel's always welcome to the party.
Always. And you
bring the pork chops.
Well, but I won't make you stand on one foot.
Right. That would be a short-lived sermon.
Well, it was. It was three lines.
Right.
The entirety of Torah.
It's been a good conversation. I appreciate really a lot of what both of you said, but Chris in particular, about the idea that people are so used to hearing these words that they don't get agitated by them. That complacency. So how do you people understand that these aren't, that nothing about this particular text is a complacent text, that it's a very active, very, like you were saying, Charles, it's a text that really calls to action. Mm-hmm. If you're listening closely to it.
And we unfortunately have churches and preachers and others are at fault for that, but where we have both some real metaphoric opiate addicts.
Mm-hmm.
Marks. See, I got Marks in there. There we go. Right.
Yeah. There we go. Some Hillel, some Marks. Who other great Jews can we quote?
It's a good day.
You want me to sing Candyman? We'll just go ahead and add Sammy Davis to the... You're talking about great Jews. I was trying to think.
Yeah.
I'm going to have fucking song stuck in my head the rest of the night. And so I got nobody to yell at but me.
Yeah.
So I think what's our words of wisdom for the day, Charles?
Our words of wisdom for the day. Today's Bob Marley, or would have been Bob Marley's birthday. So we're being interfaithed. We have to bring in the Rasta. And this wasn't necessarily appropriate when I put it, but thanks to the last few comments from Chris is extremely now relevant. So Bob Marley, Bob Marley once said, "Politics and church are the same. They keep the people in ignorance."
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah.
Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire. Shoulda, woulda, coulda, but I didn't, that's for real. You can't get back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you gotta live with that. If you learn from your mistakes, you'll get another chance at that.